Hello, book lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the entire world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. And if you're like me, and you get tired of seeing the same old titles on every bestseller list, you're in the right place. Because on this show, you'll hear from authors who aren't famous yet, but probably will be. And remember, you heard them here first. Speaking of which, last season, I spoke to Colwell Brown about her brand new debut, We Pretty Pieces of Flesh. That book was just longlisted for the Center for Fiction's first novel prize. You can catch that conversation on the NHPR website or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, I am so excited to introduce you to debut novelist Chiara Alegria Hudiz and her book, The White Hot. Chiara, welcome to Check This Out. I am unbelievably excited to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Okay, so I have to admit that I'm a little bit starstruck because while you are a debut novelist, and I have debut novelists on this show most of the time, you've actually already won a Pulitzer for your play, Water by the Spoonful, and a Tony for the Broadway musical In the Heights, which is one of my favorite musicals of all times. And now you have a debut novel, unbelievable, The White Hot. So, Chiara, just can you tell me about the book? We're going to start with this book, and I'm going to try to get over this starstruckness that's happening out here in the studio.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks.
What is The White Hot about? Give us the plot.
The White Hot, it's about a mother and a daughter who are estranged from each other. And on the daughter's 18th birthday, she receives a letter from her long-lost mother. And the mother explains, this is what happened in the 10 days I left you and why those 10 days turned into 10 years. So it's basically a mother's explanation to her girl about why she left. And this explanation arrives on the cusp of the girl's womanhood because the mom has things to say about what she's learned about becoming a woman.
But also, I think this format and the way that you told the story made the mother, April is her name, real in a way that I think mothers often aren't real for their daughters or their sons, right, for their families. I think mothers are often the figure of mother, and you don't actually get to know them in any sort of close, personal way, not the way we do in your book, The White Hot.
Well, I set out intent to write a bad mom. That was the kind of above the fold headline of what I wanted to do. I come from a very matriarchal family, a lot of women who sacrificed a lot of themselves in order to fulfill the duty of motherhood, of sisterhood, of aunthood, of grandmotherhood, of daughterhood. And getting to be a certain age, I'm about to turn 48, I thought, you know, what if they had said, you know, to hell with that. I am going to live the life I want to live. So in some ways, it was a little wish thought for these women who did not get to fulfill their desires, their dreams, did not get to act on their frustrations and take off. And so, so that's why we get such a direct view of her, because she's not a figure of some amazing mom. She's a real woman, and her flaws cost her tremendously. She no longer knows her daughter. And the question that the book asks, and really that the reader has to grapple with, is that okay? Was the price worth it?
I want to go back to this idea that you set out to write a bad mom, because I always stop on that phrase, bad mom, because I feel like there's so much pressure on mothers, on women to live up to this idea. Like, what is a good mom? You're home for dinner, you're at events, you're at school. Like, what is it? And why do we feel this pressure to be a good mom versus a bad mom? And you tackle that head on right in the beginning when you bring up, I thought, Siddhartha and Hermann Hesse's novel, right? And this idea of how different it is for a woman to be a parent versus a man. Let's talk about that. And let's talk about this idea of bad mom, because I kind of want to erase it. I don't even want to hear bad mom in a way.
Yeah, sure. That's part of the project, is to write one and therefore to kind of pull back the curtain on whether that's such a thing. I remember reading Siddhartha, like many did, high school assigned reading, and I was straight up jealous. I was like, I want that. Why does he get to leave and discover the meaning of life and sit by a river and become the Buddha? Like, I want to do that. And I already had a sense that that was out of, he had left his family, that's not something girls did. Guys got to go, leave their families and go discover the meaning of life. It wasn't just Siddhartha that I felt jealous of. I had this experience a lot high school reading. I remember reading Death of a Salesman, one of the first plays I ever read, and thinking, you know, how come he gets to have the like mental crisis? I think his wife should have that. I was jealous of him getting to take up all of this emotional bandwidth. Anyway, so I always wanted to have, I wanted my mom to be able to run away. My mom's a deeply spiritually gifted woman. I witnessed this growing up. Why didn't she get to leave me and go sit by a river, go follow the enlightened ones, because she had dinner to cook me. What's up with that? And for me growing up, really a lot of my family members, a lot of my community members, we didn't have dads. That was just a fact of life as opposed to the main story. Whereas if the mom had taken off and disappeared, that would be the main story, right? What's interesting is that once I wrote this book and then my mom read it, she said, you know, there were a lot of women in the community. And when I say the community, that's my shorthand phrase for the Puerto Rican community in North Philadelphia. My mom told me, she said, you know, a lot of women in the community. Why do you think that that there were grandmothers and aunts raising family members? Because there were moms that took off and we didn't talk about it. So it's almost like I had my finger on the pulse of a little community secret without knowing for sure, without realizing that was the case.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. My guest today is Chiara Alegría Hudiz, and you are listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. We are talking about Chiara's brand new debut novel, The White Hot.
Oh, sorry.
This is Emily Quirk. She's the big boss. Okay. Do we have something wrong with the sound?
I just want to make sure that this is...
Uh-oh.
That's okay.
Once I recorded an entire interview and we hadn't hit record, that was a disaster.
Okay, so now we're good.
That hurts.
Have you done that?
I was a composer in college and Wynton Marsalis visited and said, have you ever written a trumpet piece? And I lied and I said, yes. And he said, bring it tomorrow and I'll play it. So I stayed up all night and wrote a trumpet piece. He said, bring a tape recorder. And I brought the tape recorder. We played it together. It was for piano. I played on piano and he played the trumpet. And my tape recorder had run out of batteries after about like 7 notes. So.
Oh my God, that's horrible. Wait, I love that you said that because I was taking a creative writing class with Jamaica Kincaid in college. And she asked me, I know, and she asked me if I had any other work that I wanted to share with her. And I was like, oh my God, yes? And that was a total lie. And I stayed up all night and wrote a short story for her.
Oh, love. She's one of the, I really think she's a tentpole voice for me writing this, writing The White Hot. I had this book list that I read. I've never quite had this before. Almost a syllabus of women who really broke the mold, whose project was just totally not interested in pleasing anyone, in likability, in fulfilling any notion of a role they should do. And Jamaica Kincaid's up there, autobiography of my mother. That was central for me writing this book.
What was it about that book that was so important to you?
There was two passages in Autobiography of My Mother. One is Shuela, I think her name is pronounced. The protagonist, there's a passage where she says, whatever she was told to hate, she loved and loved the most. So she was told to hate the way her body smelled. She was told to hate the sense of her unwashed mouth in the morning. And she says she loved those things with the fervor of the devoted. And that sense of self-love in as a refutation of sexism, of kind of colonial disgust with her being a Black girl. I loved that. I thought that was extraordinary. And there's another passage in Jamaica Kincaid in that book that really struck me. She puts together, she gets pregnant, and she goes to some sort of medicine woman, and she puts together a potion to self-abort. And the way that is described, how she terminates that pregnancy, it is not described as sensational. It is not described as apologetic. It is not described as sinful. It is not described as a purgation. It's described as an event she does in her life. I thought, whoa, okay, here we go. Bad mom. Like, you're on my radar now.
That's incredible. I kind of can't believe you're bringing this up because I was in her class when that book published.
Wow.
And I went to the launch and I just sat there. I remember it was this huge theater in the middle of Harvard Square. And I remember just thinking, like, I could do this as a job one day. Maybe, like, maybe someone would pay me. Like, she opened my eyes to this world of another way to live. You don't have to always follow this direct path. Right, you can find your own. You don't have to be in a straight line all the time. And it was such a big moment for me too when that book came out.
Wow. I would have loved to have been the fly on the wall there.
Yeah, and I didn't even know what a moment that was for me, for her, for, you know, for publishing to sit there. I was just some stupid, you know, sophomore.
When I read that book, I wrote The White Hot. Now, this has nothing to do with what's in the book itself, but I wrote The White Hot at one of the most difficult periods of my life because I had a family member who was not well, and the caretaking was extremely stressful and difficult. And somehow, I could not wash a dish. I mean, I felt not functional. Every ounce of energy I had was going into caretaking for this person. And yet, while I couldn't wash a dish, somehow I emerged from this 2-year period having written a book. I don't know how it happened. It reminded me I existed. I had a self. And reading this kind of short stack of books in which Jamaica Kincaid was one of the authors also reminded me I have a self. I still have an internal life, even though I felt untethered from most of the world. You know, her book did save me. I've heard this thing. People say, oh, books save me. I'm like, yeah, that's cute. I get it. I love books too. And then it happened to me, and it was pretty remarkable. And I loved that book so much. After I read it, I ran out. I said, what did critics say about this at the time? So I Googled, you know, New York Times book review. And the critic hated it. I mean, really hated it. It was severe. It was vitriolic. I said, this woman, this author paid the price for writing this vision of this girl. So I was very inspired by Jamaica and some other books in that short stack. And I wanted to add to that stack. I said, you know, I've got a bad mom in me too. And I love her dearly. I want to feel her mistakes and her regrets and the price she paid. And I also want to feel the freedom that she grabbed for herself in that act.
My guest today is Kiara Alegria Hudiz, and we are talking about her brand new debut novel, The White Hot. Kiara, I want to ask you to read for us from this beautiful, beautiful book that I could not put down. I want to just note that it's only 160 pages. I read it in one sitting, straight through, absolutely gorgeous, every sentence. Before I ask you to read, I do need to give some trigger warnings for where this conversation may go. We're going to talk about abandonment, child neglect, and abuse, possibly, during this interview. If you are struggling with any of these issues, you can text BEGIN, BEGIN, to 88788, the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Kiara, would you please read for us?
Sure. Well, I thought I'd read a passage. My heroine, April Soto, she has a just really bad day. She's so stressed. She's so overwhelmed. She gets up from the dinner table and just walks out. And she walks to the Greyhound bus station. She's still in her work clothes. She's wearing her gladiator sandals and her skinny jeans and her sequin top she wore to work. She gets a ticket on the farthest she could go on the Greyhound bus. And about 12 hours later, she ends up in Ohio Pile State Park in western Pennsylvania. Now, she has never hiked. She has never taken a walk in the woods. But here she goes in her clothes. And I thought I'd read about the beginning of this journey she takes. She says, "I walked for hours along a riverside. For the first few miles, a dull mental refrain looped. Turn back, April, you've had your moment. But the decisiveness of my feet was hard to refute. They were calling the shots. They seemed in charge. I kept telling myself this hike was nothing, the stroll meant nothing, and all the while my legs plowed onward. I couldn't square my own jumbled impulses. I was taking directions from an aspect of myself I had no acquaintance with. My blister was penance for hopping a Greyhound, fair enough, but new ones emerged in a spreading fire. I adjusted my stride, stepping vertically rather than horizontally, but the dots still threw their hot artillery. Turns out Ohio Pile houses no Walgreens, and fir trees don't sell Band-Aids. My purse, with its mini bundle of tissues, was probably still on the toilet tank back home. What protection would a Kleenex offer anyway? A strap digs in, its slender jaw a metronome of discomfort. I stopped, readjusted the rhinestone slats, shifting their pleather onto unbroken skin, but walking revealed this would only broaden the destruction, so I moved the straps back onto the established blisters, where they improved on their original course. The dots widened, wetted themselves, juiced my sandals with clear stuff. If interior me was slipping out through little portholes, was Ohio Pile slipping in? I sat, pressed the exposed pools with careful, curious fingertips, then peeled off loose flaps, smelled them, studying myself, and left those bits of me behind. A slower course now, a kinder version of dead inside. Inhale. Skin heals, April. Exhale. Skin heals. With that mantra, the little sores grew hurtful and curative. All at once, not a reduction of pain, but an inclusion of soothing, a blister-sized faith, a practice."
Just beautiful. And I love this passage that you chose because it's so gritty and visceral. You talk about a blister and the sort of grossness of the clear stuff that comes out of your skin. And I can feel this trying to move the strap, you know, so it's not getting so bad. But then you realize that's just ridiculous. And there's so many metaphors in this grittiness, right, that makes her human and yet makes me think about so many things. Let's talk about April. Tell us about April, this main character in your brand new debut, The White Hot.
So in that passage, she refers to this phrase, dead inside. And she's got all these tricks in her regular life in North Philly. She's 26 years old. She lives with her mother, her grandmother, and her 10-year-old daughter. And she's got all these tricks to feel less, to kind of tamp down the stress and the pressure of helping support these women. One trick is she puts on her Beats headphones and listens to Ocean Sounds app. Another trick is she has this mantra she repeats in her head, dead inside, just to kind of numb her wild feelings. And then it stops working. And she just freaks out and she feels everything for the remainder of the book. There is no way she can ignore these feelings that have built up inside her. And so, yes, the book is... it's a series of firsts that she should have had as a girl and as a teenager that she didn't have the opportunity to have. And so now she has these firsts as a young woman. And she's, as she experiences them, there's that kind of belated coming of age. But there's also a sense of sorrow. Why didn't I feel this when I was a child? We learn over the course of the book why. And these four women are clinging to each other in her household. As Puerto Rican migrants who ended up in Philadelphia, they're clinging to each other for ballast because they're survivors of domestic violence. And they can't even talk about it. They can't talk about these experiences they all witnessed together and experienced together because it would be like poking the wound. And she doesn't know how to move forward. And in fact, her way of moving forward, we learn by the end of this book, is to basically break the household by leaving it. That's her solution, and to get her daughter out of there too. So it's there's sadness, but there's a lot of playfulness because, of course, you know, when you're a girl experiencing firsts, you get to be playful. You get to be embarrassed and shy. You get to be curious. She has spiritual revelations. She's grown up in a religious household, but she's really never felt the spirit. But here, freed from the kind of religious context of her family, she has spiritual revelations in the woods, walking by a river like Siddhartha does.
These wounds, or this wound that haunts April, your main character in The White Hot, is so well hidden, and also well hidden with the actually how it happened. So we learn over the course of the book that she watched her father beat her mother with a floorboard. And then, you know, and that was horrific, horrific. And then she wakes up and the floorboard is back in place, exactly like nothing had ever happened. And that's sort of the way her life had been up to that point, was let's cover it up, let's pretend it didn't happen, let's move on, go to work, go to school, right? And that was so powerful.
Oh, it's hard for me to even think about. It's not a long passage in the book, but it's when it gets there, you know, it's the source of a lot of the emotional timbre and texture of her life. And she was very young when she witnessed this act of violence. And she becomes a fighter herself. She becomes a little street fighter in the schoolyard. She gets in a lot of trouble at school, starting in grade school. But the thing is, yes, she wakes up in the morning after her father has kind of ripped loose this loose floorboard that was in the stairs and hit her mom with it. And it's back in place. And in fact, it's repaired, so it's not even loose anymore. And this sense of, did that even happen? It makes her question her own reality. It is such a clear message to her and to the whole household that whoever repaired it overnight, her dad left, so it wasn't her dad, whichever one of the women repaired it overnight, the message is, we're moving on from this. We're not talking about it. You know, let's deal with today. And that level of survival is remarkable. It's an accomplishment, but it also has tremendous and steep costs. And April bears the burden of those costs. She was 5 that night. She could not protect her mother. And now there's a sense that she can't even hug her mom and say, hey, how are you? Because the house has been repaired, period. It's over. It's done.
It's just heartbreaking, and I cried as I read it. And even though, as you said, it was such a short passage, but it was so moving and so deep in just so few words, this idea that you can cover it up, and did it even happen? So let's focus a little bit more on Noelle. Noelle is April's child. So April had her when she was 16 years old, and she is the star behind sort of everything that's happening in this book, because The White Hot is a letter to her, to Noelle. And April goes on her journey. It's really started when she goes to an art classroom presentation, and Noelle sits there and is presenting her work. So tell us about that moment and what this kicks off.
Yeah, that's kind of the first domino that tips over, and then it's, you know, it's all a chain reaction after that. So Noelle is a talented and bright little girl, just like her mom. April was a gifted student, and from her teacher's point of view, and maybe from her own point of view, did not fulfill her potential and promise when she had to drop out of school. And so she's going to this art fair at school one day. All the kids had to draw my family home. And Noelle, this little 10-year-old, I mean, she's a gifted enough kid that she's basically created a crayon satire of her home in some ways to get a rise out of her mom. She knows her mom's coming to this art fair, and she's going to kind of humiliate her mom by what she draws. So what she draws is an absolutely spotless Section 8 home. Because these women clean the house within an inch of their lives. Okay, everything is polished, everything is spotless. And so Noelle depicts this with a kind of satirical edge to it. And she shows her mom sitting on the edge of the bed, her back to the viewer. So she's drawn the back of her mom's head. and her mom has her headphones on. And just this kind of scathing portrait of her mom's remove from the household, from her own emotions, from her life. And it's embarrassing. And also April's embarrassed by how talented her daughter is too. There's that sense of, you know, why are we different? Noelle is, even though she's in fourth grade, she has to leave the art fair early to go to algebra, which is a ninth grade class. And all the parents kind of comment on that. And so she feels called out publicly by that. And that is what tips the dominoes. Noelle gets in a fight later that day at school, and she gets called in the April gets called in the principal's office, a place where she spent much time when she was a high schooler herself, because she was always in trouble. And this is what starts to kind of build the pressure cooker of April's day that she's got to get out.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. My guest today is Chiara Alegria Hudiz, and you are listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. We are talking about Chiara's brand new debut novel, The White Hot, and we are focusing on the daughter in this book, Noelle. She starts it all, and her mother, April, is in the art classroom. We're in the very, very beginning of this novel, and she's seeing her daughter's portrayal of their life. Which is kind of a way of her wanting to start a fight. And this is how we get to the idea of the white hot. So let's talk about the title and this anger and how this plays into the book.
Okay, so I was very interested in exploring women's anger. I think in some ways because it's not an emotion I'm in particularly good touch with. And I just thought, you know, I want an angry young woman. And what does that look like? What does that feel like? In my research and in speaking to people who have more access to their anger, some family members included, I heard this description that, you know, when you really freak out, it almost can like blind you. It can feel like an electricity is zapping you. It can feel like you're just seeing just bright, blinding light. And so the white hot is basically a description of April Soto's rages when she gets in these fights as a kid in elementary school, in high school. And then her daughter starts to go through them too. And the thing that I'm interested in exploring is how can that, it's a tremendous amount of energy she has, right? And it causes problems. It's a troubling energy. But if that same amount of energy could be harnessed in a different direction, you know, what could that, how far could that get her? What could she accomplish? And so she also, like I mentioned earlier, she walks into the woods. She has these kind of spiritual experiences by a river during a windstorm. And there's a sense that the white hot could transform into something sacred and something divine. If she could only get there, if she could only figure out how to get that rage and funnel it in a different way, or crack it open and let its light shine rather than respond with a balled up fist.
What really struck me about the way you wrote about fighting and this anger was that it's very visceral. So first of all, you're starting with, let's talk about angry women. Right. And most people don't want to talk about that. They want women and girls to smile and look happy. Right. Instead, you're saying we're going to go straight to the anger. And then you describe the fights and April's memories of them as very, gritty and visceral. Right. The snap of cartilage, the feel of flesh that gives. Right. The warmth of blood that's coming down. You explain these using terms that I don't usually see when you hear about men fighting in books, right? It was more like an emotional, they're actually destroying flesh in your book is how I read it. It was a very different description of a fight as opposed to, you know, his head went left, it jutted back, it hurt his knee, right? Instead of a blow by blow. And I wondered if you could talk about how you thought about those fights, if that was on purpose, you know, and or if that's just how they came to you.
From what I've seen and from my point of view, there's a profound intimacy to it. This sense of flesh on flesh, you know, the famous paintings of Jacob wrestling his angel. If you see a boxing match and that grapple where they're just locked together, you know, there is something profoundly almost tender about the amount of flesh that makes contact. And sometimes it can become confusing. There can be confusing moments in a physical fight where it's, are we hugging? Are we, I'm breathing, my hot breath is on your neck, you know? And so I wanted to explore that. And another important part of it is that after she fights, you know, this rage overcomes her, this white hot overcomes her, but then it goes and she's always crashes after and she gets really ashamed after. Why did I do that? Why did I let that happen to me? Why did I hurt someone? What was I thinking? Just this sense that she's really trapped in a cycle that she can't control.
I love that we're talking about this intimacy that's experienced with fights, because I think that April also feels that with music for the first time after she's gone out into the world. She's on her trek out to Pittsburgh and she's in the woods and she meets a man, Kamal, and he introduces her to jazz for the first time. And it's, you write it in very similar way, right? This intimacy with the music. Can you talk about that scene and how she sort of becomes aware of herself and the world around her through this music?
So this character, April Soto, if we had read about her life up until the point where the book begins, it would have been somewhat insular. Its scope, its geographical scope would have been limited. She really hasn't spent any time out of her North Philly neighborhood. But we find her, the record needle drops on this story at a moment when she takes off and leaves the state for the first time. And one of her firsts is that she meets a man in the woods when she's walking. They kind of develop an interest in each other. He takes her home, and he's an audiophile. He's got a fantastic vinyl setup. He's wealthy. He's got a fantastic vinyl setup at his house, and he has stacks and stacks of well-preserved records. And his favorite is Charles Mingus. So he drops the needle. They're drinking wine. She's not really had wine before, you know, so she's really tipsy, and they're listening to Mingus, and they're listening in particular to his more raucous music, which is a lot of it. And this sense of, why have I never heard this music before? This sense of, if I had heard what someone can do, Charles Mingus in her hearing is clearly an angry person, is an argumentative person, is a natural born fighter, but he funnels it all into something productive and beautiful, which is jazz. And she's suddenly embarrassed. She thinks, if only I had an outlet like this in my life, if only I knew it was possible to take all of my confusion, all of my resentment, all of my stress and create beauty from it, what could I have been? But she also knows she's only 26. It's not too late. Maybe there's something she can figure out here. So she becomes a Mingus aficionado. Then she hears Hendrix for the first time, and she hears Joni Mitchell for the first time. And so it really is this kind of crucible of, when you're an adolescent and you hear these musics for the first time, it's really maybe like a 6 or 8 year stretch where you're becoming yourself through all these different sounds, you know, and she does it in 2 days.
And all this music is on your playlist for the book?
Some of it. Yeah, we've got some Mingus on it. We've got some Joni on it. We also have, you know, Bad Bunny and Carol G, the kind of stuff she'd be listening to right now in the neighborhood.
So after April is out in the woods, she comes alive with this music, with her experience with Kamal. She has this sort of revelation of who she is, who she needs to become, or what she wants. And this, again, is where we go back to the idea of motherhood. What is the best thing she can do for her daughter? And she decides that it's to give her daughter up, basically, to give her to her father. And I love this moment where she walks up to the birth father, right, to April's father, and says, I've given you 10 years. Now it's your turn. And then you don't even just leave it there, because the father is now married. He has a family of his own. He has 2 young kids, and he's married to a woman, Joanna. And I feel April panicking, but then you wrote, Joanna had a pen and paper, write down her doctor's name and number. And that was the moment I knew you'd be okay. I had calculated correctly. She stood resigned to a woman's work, prepared for the burdens that others care not to shoulder. That passage, right, is where April realizes that Joanna's the good mother that she wasn't going to be at that point. And it was so powerful, just a few lines, and I've underlined it, starred it, like dog-eared. It's like, this is the heart of the book. It was just an incredible passage. Let's talk about that moment that write down her doctor's name and number. And that's how you know she's going to be in good hands.
Yeah, you know, it's just like women got work to do. And they, you know, they need the facts. They got a long to-do list. And Joanna, in that moment, activates the to-do list. It's like, okay, well, I'm taking care of business. Like, you're going to be a crazy runaway mom. I need to know where her health records are. You know, so she gets very literal-minded and functional at that moment. But I also, in that passage, I get emotional thinking about that passage. This is the first long interview I've done on this book. And so it is emotional for me to process the journey that this character went through. I think what happens with Joanna there is people know deep, dark down, and I say this in the book somewhere, people know when they've gotten a little bit of a free pass. And you're just waiting, like, when is this going to, you know, come calling? When is my debt going to come back round and the collector is going to come? And Joanna knows her husband had another baby, and he knows. And I think there's something in both of their relationships and in both of their lives that is aware, like, okay, there's this unpaid debt. And they have the good sense to not totally fight that when the collection time comes and when April says, it's your turn now.
In Siddhartha, we're going back to that because we started with that. It's right. It's in the book. When the dad walks out, there's no, oh, hold on. Here are the phone numbers. Here's the emergency contact. Here are the report cards, right? Even when April is at this moment where she's walking away, she's still going through the whole checklist of everything that a good mom would do.
Oh, gosh. No, I mean, when she pulls her car away and they're all on the stoop together, it's a pretty high intensity scene. And then she drives off and she sees they've taken Noelle inside and the door is closed. And that's a real final kind of stamp on that act. Just a sense that she wants to run inside and say, oh, wait, these are the kind of crayons she likes. Also, she hasn't gotten her period yet. Also, you know, this is the kind of food she likes. She gave all that up. She, you know, motherhood is a burden and it's a privilege. And she has to face the amount of privilege that she's just given up, which is knowing someone in such a deep and beautiful and granular way. And she's given up that thing. It's maybe the biggest accomplishment of her life so far is how well she knows her daughter. So to just say goodbye to that, it's a hard thing to face.
You do it in an incredibly beautiful way, but it also, like I said, brings to my mind this idea that until now, I'm thinking April is not a great mother. She wasn't really there for her daughter. But then when we go through this list of her talking about, you know, the crayons and she hasn't gotten her period and all this stuff, like, actually, she was a very present mother. She knew a lot more about her daughter, Noelle, than she really let on, or that you, Kiara, let on earlier in this letter.
Part of that is because it would be wrong of her to write a letter to her daughter when she turns 18 and say, hey, don't forget, like, I was there for you a lot. You know, I got you school clothes. Like, I dropped out of high school so that I could work full time and get you the things you needed. It would be unfair of her to make a laundry list of the ways that she was there. She has to own, in front of her daughter, a level of honesty that is, here's the ways I wasn't there. Here's what it cost me, but here's what I learned. And you're turning 18, daughter. I want you to know a few of the things I learned. I never got to have a birds and bees talk with you. I sacrificed that right. But just know these few things I learned, and maybe they'll be helpful for you as you become a woman.
God, it's so emotional. I feel emotional even as we're talking about this. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. If you're reading this book for your book club, we have discussion questions on our website. And let us know what your book club thought by leaving us a voice message. We would love to hear from you. books@nhpr.org is the email address. My guest today is Kiara Alegria Hudiz, and we are talking about her brand new debut novel, The White Hot. Kiara, I understand that the idea for this book came to you somewhere around 2012 while you were listening to Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. Tell us about that.
You know, it's funny. Sometimes the source of inspiration for something, it can really travel far from that. So I would say that it's fairly unrecognizable from this album, which did inspire me. But I was listening to Jagged Little Pill, and she's kind of a mad genius. She's angry and resentful of the ways that she's been hemmed in and the things she doesn't understand and that strike her as unfair about her position in life. It's all these things at once. She's so self-contradictory. She's so playful. And so I just was listening to that album on loop, and I imagined this young Puerto Rican woman in Philly who wanted that range of emotional experiences. And she got it. And as I wrote the book, it came clear to me that Alanis Morissette's music really wasn't the right style to discuss in the narrative, and that she was going to discover jazz. That was going to be a little bit more aligned with the narrative. But yeah, you know, this inspiration comes from unexpected places.
It certainly does. You mentioned Philadelphia. The book starts in Philly, is set in Philly. And as listeners know, I grew up in Philly. And anytime Philly is mentioned in a book or an author is from Philly, we have to go there. Let's talk about Philadelphia, because that city is actually a character even in this book. It's a huge part of who April and Noel become and are. Let's talk about Philadelphia.
I love that. I know It's a great city, and it's where I grew up. So I grew up in West Philly, around 49th and Baltimore, in an area of row homes and twin homes with alleys between them. A lot of it was Victorian architecture that had since been repurposed for apartments, lots of old growth trees. My extended family was in North Philly, in the Puerto Rican community. And one of the things I'll always remember, there were all sorts of different buildings in North Philly, most of them row homes. They didn't really have twin homes in the same way, except for a few blocks. They were dark. These homes were dark because they only had windows at the front and at the back, and there was a lot of space in between. And I really associate this kind of cave living in some ways, this cave lighting, I should say. I was thinking about that a lot with April Soto. And when she gets back, she leaves Philly. She's never left Philly. When she gets back to Philly, and she walks in her childhood home, she's kind of shocked by how small it seems compared to the world she's just gone out and experienced. So there's a lot of Philly in it. You know, there's the Greyhound station, there's the L train, you know, 95 North, and the billboards, the stretches of billboards and the potholes on 95 North, the perpetual road work. It's a lot of Philly in there.
A lot of Philly. And I like that also because it's such a contrast to April then going out to the woods, and she gets on this bus, right? And it's just, she goes from this very urban Philadelphia, gritty setting, you know, to the beauty, this openness that she's not prepared for in any way, including how she's dressed.
Yeah, she's dressed completely the wrong way. And there's a moment when she's sitting outside of the principal's office waiting to be called in because her daughter's in trouble. And she sees these two posters that she had spent a lot of time staring at as a teenager, too, when she was in trouble and waiting to be called into the office. And they show natural phenomena. One shows a rock climber, and it says something like, you know, the harder the climb, the better the view, or something like that. And she's laughing inside because she's like, what Philly kid has ever climbed done rock climbing? You know, it should show the bus and say, you know, the longer the wait for the bus, the harder the journey, or something like that. One of the things that I intuited growing up in Philly but didn't fully understand until I left was it's the fourth most segregated city in the nation. And I felt that in the community, and it bothered me. It bothered me because it felt there was an invisibility infrastructurally. I could see. I went to school up at Central, in a different part of North Philly. I would go hang out in Center City, and I could see, like, okay, some neighborhoods had better and more consistent trash pickup than others. You know, and I just give that as one example. So April's gone from a very insular and segregated community to a world where no one is much like her. And how is she equipped to bring herself into that wider world?
I love that you brought up the segregation in Philadelphia, because I think people don't talk about it very much. But if you grow up there, you just know, you're taught, for example, you can't walk on this side of the street, but you can walk on this side of the street. And don't cross this street. You cannot go to that little 7-Eleven, but you can go to the one two blocks this way, right? Like, that one's safe, this one's not, right? That's just how we're raised. And you know, to anybody else, it's like, oh, you're just crossing the street. Let's go to the sunny side, the shady side. It's like, you know, whereas my experience was, no, we walk on this side, not that side, or whatever, right? That's how I was raised. And that's really sad and difficult thing to explain to people.
Philly is a city of invisible borders. Mm-hmm. And you can almost feel it in the air pressure. You almost don't have to be told, don't cross the street here, because the streets have decades, generations of memory built up around that you can almost feel it. And April's this character that also has so many invisible walls, so much invisible armor built up around her, coming from a city of invisible borders, that how small your life has become is almost unnoticeable to you, right? It's that David Foster Wallace thing of the two fish are swimming and they come to an older fish, and the older fish says, hey, how's the water? And the little kid fish are like, what's water? You know, she doesn't even recognize how insular and small her life has become, but something in her knows. And that's why when she's having dinner towards the beginning at home, towards the beginning of the book, and she just hears this little voice, got to go. The smallest little whisper of a voice, got to go. And that voice is right. And she goes, and she starts to see what had become invisible. She starts to see more clearly in her life.
The White Hot is a letter from a mother to her daughter that's meant to be opened on her daughter's 18th birthday. And on the surface, it spans 10 days when the mother flees for 10 days to sort of find herself before she comes back. But really, this book is much more expansive than that. It's more like 10 years, the journey. And you seamlessly go between this idea of 10 days, 10 years. It's very intimate, short timeline to this very sprawling timeline. Let's talk about these parameters. How did you think about that as you were writing the book?
It's tricky because I wonder how long, you know, how did April write this, all these pages? Did she sit and write them in a week and take off from work that week? You know, is it something she had thought about from the moment she left her daughter? One day I'm going to tell her, one day I'm going to tell her. But what will I tell her? What does she need to know? And I don't totally know the answer to that. I remember I have siblings who are much younger than me, who are 11 and 13 years younger than me. And when I became a young adult, I used to want to write them letters and explain to them, here's what happened in our family. Here's why we're half siblings. Here's why, you know, you grew up in that house and I grew up in this house. I wanted to explain that to them, my world. And something in that impulse lives in April Soto. And so there's a sense of time kind of always nest, like a set of Russian nesting dolls kind of collapsing in on itself, where the formative days becomes the whole life too.
Kiara, I have absolutely loved our conversation. Thank you so much for joining me on Check This Out.
Thanks. It was really fun to talk.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna. You have been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my all-time favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer today is Jessica Hunt. Penn Faulkner's executive director is Gwydion Sullivan. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. The show is sponsored by CNS Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books we're talking about here this season. Thanks so much for listening. Read on.